I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today we're joined by a distinguished correspondent and columnist, Louis Jacobson. Mr. Jacobson has spent a decade covering politics, policy, Congress for the National Journal. He's also the senior author for the Almanac of American Politics. He, since 2004, has been writing a column on politics in the states. And this column's run in Roll Call, stateline.org, and Governing. Currently, he is dividing his time between a column for The Port, Sabato's Crystal Ball, and U.S. News & World Report. He's won numerous awards as a correspondent and journalist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I know you've written a bit about this first issue that we want to start off with, and that is the California recall. Of course, the recall is over. Excuse me, Gavin Newsom is the winner. So what did this tell us about California politics, but more broadly about partisan struggles as we, you know, think ahead to the midterms and also to the presidential election?
Yeah, so Democrats have to be pretty happy about the California result, but of course, take everything with a grain of salt. It's California. It's a blue state. Joe Biden won it going away about a year ago. And so, you know, the situation in California will not necessarily replay itself everywhere. I think probably the biggest positive takeaway for the Democrats is that they can feel more comfortable kind of feeling like they're on the politically safer side in terms of handling the pandemic. You didn't see a lot of Democrats who ordinarily would be okay with Newsom, but might be, you know, annoyed with his stances in terms of business closures or coronavirus restrictions. In fact, he seems to have won most of the people who are pretty satisfied with the way the coronavirus has been fought in California. So as far as the GOP side, it probably, well, for one thing, it does make it more difficult going forward for them to really try this recall route because it did fail so spectacularly. California has this weird recall rule. It only takes, I think it's 12% of the voters in the previous statewide election for the governor's office to sign a petition and have the recall, which is a pretty low bar. It's, I think, pretty easily the lowest bar of any state for a recall. And there's no requirement that the governor, you know, have done anything criminally wrong or ethically wrong. And then, of course, have this weird structure where you first vote yes or no to keep the governor or junk the governor. And then on the second part, whoever wins in the second part for the replacement becomes governor. So you have a situation where, you know, many more people vote to keep the governor, but it just isn't a majority. And then somebody in a very large field, I think there were 40 odd candidates this time, could split the vote, and the governor chosen on the second question could actually have far, far fewer votes than the sitting governor did. So it's a weird system. It was already kind of under pressure, but now this shows that even given the chance of a low turnout election and a recall compared to a regular gubernatorial election in the state, that the GOP couldn't even come close to winning that. It sort of takes that off the table, at least for the foreseeable future, not to mention reminding people how weird the system is. And there's now a lot of talk about getting rid of it or reforming it so that it's a much more difficult system to trigger in the first place.
So there are a number of things there. I want to unpack a couple. First of all, it is a very blue state, as you point out, but it seemed to be like nobody could get much of a purchase against Newsom's pandemic restrictions, which, you know, frankly, have been pretty broad and pretty more so than certainly in red states, but it didn't work against him. One of the things that seemed to get a lot of press that I thought it was indicative of our current times was the dinner at the French Laundry. I mean, this really fueled an enormous amount of populist kind of anger, particularly on the right, but maybe also, I think, people, just general moderates and people kind of in the middle. Is that so? If you kind of extrapolate from that, do you say, well, maybe running specifically against pandemic restrictions is not going to work, but running against elites who are out of touch might work?
Yeah, no, it's certainly a plausible strategy. I think one of the things that really helped Newsom in this case is that the state does have a mail ballot, vote by mail, basically universal. They sent out ballots to every registered voter. So what that meant was that even if you were kind of, you know, annoyed at the governor, at some of his actions, like the French Laundry, and maybe wouldn't, you know, head out in the rain or whatever on like election day to go to the polls or to, you know, sign up in advance to get a mail ballot sent to you. Even if you didn't feel strongly enough, all you had to do was basically check two boxes on this ballot that was like already sitting in your mailbox and then drop it off at the nearest mailbox or drop box. If the threshold for voting is higher, only a more agitated section of the voter base is going to come out. But it really helped him in a very blue state to basically make voting as easy as possible. So it's not like you have to really, you know, go out on a limb for Newsom. All you got to do is check two boxes if you feel like he's better than the alternative.
Now, vote integrity and fraud has been a big issue in, you know, all the way across the country. I don't need to remind anyone of that.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, you know, it was a vote by mail, universal vote by mail. And then you saw the chief Republican candidate, Larry Elder, kind of run up that fraud flag to see if anybody mm-hmm. would salute. But then stepped away from that stance or backed it down. What is it? I mean, mm-hmm. is fraud going to continue to be a major issue as moving forward, or was that a relic of 2016 and 2020 that's losing purchase?
I do think that it's going to stick around at least a while longer. It's so fundamental to the Trump persona and, argument. He's considering running again in 2024. All the candidates who have a good chance of winning, it seems like, on the GOP side are, you know, aligned with Trump and feel, even if they in their heart of hearts may not, agree with it, it's still very useful for them to stay on the same side, on the good side of Trump and on his supporters, who are very, very much driving the party today. So I don't think it's going to go away. Its effectiveness as an issue, of course, will depend. It'll, in a blue state like California, in a solidly blue state like California, it's not going to work as well, except among a small group of people. But in more red states, where the GOP is dominant and the Democrats really don't have a strong chance of winning in most elections, at least statewide elections, it's still going to be an issue, I think, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we are, in case you just turned in, talking today with Lewis Jacobson, who is quite a distinguished political columnist nationwide, has columns that run in the Cook Political Report, Sabatos, Crystal Ball, and U.S. News and World Report. Okay, well, let's move on to the House, which is coming up. As we've seen with this recent, debt, can the U.S. pay its debts going forward and other kinds of issues, the Democrats have a razor-thin majority in the House and an even slimmer majority, if you can even call it that, in the Senate. So what are the prospects for 2022 bringing the Republicans back into a majority in both House and Senate?
So it's definitely stronger in the House than in the Senate, although it's perfectly possible in the Senate as well. That says it's not a done deal. We still have a long way to go until Election Day, and a lot depends on how Joe Biden is seen around the time of the election. If he has decent approval ratings in the few months before the election, he could do better than most presidents do. Most presidents lose seats in at least the House, if not the Senate, in their first midterm, and certainly the political environment will matter. The other thing that really matters in the House is redistricting. Every 10 years, the census comes out, and the parties, the states redraw their district lines for the House and for the state House and Senate. So that is happening right now. It was a bit delayed because of the census delays, but it's going on right now. The GOP has more unified control in terms of number of seats for the House. What that means is that the governor and the state legislature are in GOP hands. There are a bunch of states which do it by commission, which is a bipartisan system. So those are a little bit harder to predict and may not lean towards one party or the other. But in terms of pure control, there's a bunch of seats that the GOP will redraw and a smaller number of seats that the Democrats are going to draw, although the Democrats will likely have a pretty strong hand in, say, New York State, for instance. Which could eat into the margin that the GOP would get in terms of redrawing districts. The general consensus kind of going into the redistricting cycle is that the GOP could, on net, gain perhaps five seats, maybe more, maybe less, in the redistricting process, which just happens by chance to be the number of seats dividing the two parties in the House. So it could almost work out that the GOP comes into the majority just based on the changes in district lines alone. It's definitely an uphill battle. Earlier in this year, I thought that maybe, Joe Biden would basically benefit from having vanquished the virus. We had just gotten the vaccine. A lot of people were taking it, and then we kind of hit a brick wall. Now, it's hard to blame Biden fully for this, given that most of the increases in the caseload and the deaths have been in red states, where GOP governors have been, shall we say, doing a pretty different type of approach to the virus. It's certainly no guarantee that he's going to be on the kind of upswing that maybe I would have thought a couple months ago, but there's still a long time to go. And I think the battle against the coronavirus, where that stands, how people feel about it in the months before the election, as well as a related issue, and that's the economy, if that seems to be getting better, then I think Biden will be in better shape, but he certainly has an uphill battle to save the House. On the Senate side, the Democrats do have a bunch of pickup opportunities. I think Pennsylvania and Wisconsin probably head that list, also North Carolina, maybe on the outside even Florida or Ohio. But they also have to defend against a couple possible losses, Arizona, New Hampshire, and Nevada, and especially in Georgia. Compared to the House, the Senate is a bit better roadmap to a majority for the Democrats. Now, that said, if the Democrats manage to maintain their majority in the Senate in 2022, it's going to be really tough in 2024 because there are a bunch of very difficult states that, including, I believe, Montana and West Virginia, that they'd have to defend in 2024. It's hard to imagine the Democrats having more than 2 years of a Senate majority going forward. And of course, the Senate is drawn state by state. So California has two seats and Wyoming has two seats. So the long-term structural disadvantage for the Democrats, which I've written about, is pretty significant. I did a piece once. If you kind of color in the seats in the Senate based on what the presidential leanings are for that state. You give two seats for the solidly blue state to Democrats, two seats for the solidly red states for the GOP, and split the seats for the swing states. The sort of long-term equilibrium is to have a GOP edge in the Senate of 53 to 47. The fact that they have a majority now, a bare bones majority, is fairly remarkable. Not sort of guaranteed in the long term.
Yeah, there's a lot there, of course, and I want to unpack a bunch of it. Let's take that last thing. I mean, two of those seats in the in the Senate that are giving the Democrats that majority right now, which seems a little bit out of line with what you would say generally structurally for American politics, two of those seats are from the Georgia election, right, which might be seen as self-sabotage given the antics of Donald Trump as the election. So really it's remarkable that without that you don't have Democrats where they are now, and you're much closer to that 53-47 that you mentioned.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, the fact that Democrats could hold two Georgia seats, two Arizona seats, one Ohio seat, one West Virginia seat, one Montana seat, and still barely get the majority because they happen to have a vice president of the same party is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that's a feat unlikely to be repeated ad infinitum, so to speak. One of those rare things. So I don't think Democrats should get too comfortable. Of course, we could inveigh on a different program at another time about the structural inequities of the American system of government right now,
sure,
which seem to be favoring what is a fairly significant minority. I know there's a parlor game on the Democratic side. It's not a happy game. It's a sort of like a, you know, spin the suicide pistol to say how many points over a majority do Democrats have to win to actually gain control of the government. And so we saw, Democrats in this last election won by 7 million popular votes, but that translated really into a very, very, very slim majority. So, Clinton won the popular vote by 2.5 points, but, lost that election. And so, it's but that's a parlor game. I'd rather play it another time.
sure.
So let's looking ahead at thinking about 2024, is it likely to be a referendum on Biden? Are people still going to remember Afghanistan? Why is Biden getting a black eye for COVID when it's people who don't support him in states that aren't for him that, in fact, seem to be doing the damage? And what the heck is going to happen with the economy?
Yeah.
Solve
right.
all that for me in the next minute or two.
Okay. Well, in terms of the economy, it is heavily linked to COVID. I think you ask a very good question. Why are people, blaming Biden when it's really not his fault? I think my best answer is that's why he gets paid the big bucks. Like people, particularly those who don't follow the ins and outs of politics like you and me, know who the president is, may not know much about their governor. They may. But ultimately kind of the buck stops there. And Biden may be justified in thinking, hey, that's not fair. But it's kind of true. I do think that how Biden is seen is going to play a role, at least on the margins. We do have a highly polarized electorate. So Democrats are still strongly behind Biden. Republicans are strongly against him. And then the small segment of persuadable independents are the ones probably who are going to decide it. It also matters on the in terms of Democratic base. Will they show up or will they be kind of agnostic and sort of hang back? That is going to be a huge decisive factor. Will Afghanistan in particular matter? generally speaking, in American politics, foreign policy, unless you're actually losing like large numbers of people overseas in wars, tends not to be a driver of like political choices. So the thinking is that it won't be specifically an issue. You know, of course, if there are terrorist attacks, like large and you know, widespread terrorist attacks because of the withdrawal, that could have an impact, but that's speculative. But I do think that the initial images, even though, you know, the Biden administration says with some justification that they carried out a huge, you know, program to take people out, airlift people out, and it was pretty successful in the end. First impressions are hard to break, and it didn't seem like the U.S. was doing a good job, and it got a lot of media coverage. The specifics of the issue may not matter, but it does sort of ding his confidence a little bit, competence a bit. And that is what he campaigned on, that Trump was not competent, he said, and that he would steady things. And I think in a lot of ways he probably has. I think people were getting tired of sort of having to think about what Donald Trump might do and what policies he would do and what sort of behind the scenes kind of maneuvering he would do. And for the most part, I think people are tuned in less to the news because Biden is not sort of doing dramatic things of that sort, worrisome things. But he did campaign as a competent guy, and the Afghanistan situation combined with COVID, even though COVID may not really be all his fault, probably don't help his chances of a good Democratic tide in 2022.
I sometimes wonder, by the way, if you just tuned in, we're talking to distinguished political correspondent and columnist Lewis Jacobson today, who writes for a number of national outlets. I sometimes wonder if, you know, the relative calm we're experiencing under Biden, and it is relative, I have to say.
Yeah, sure.
Is it resonates with people as good times or a relief. Certainly does, I think, in among people who are Democrats. I'm just not sure that translates for other people into that kind of sense of like, oh, everything's right with the world.
Right. Yeah. No, I think the polling in terms of, you know, is the country on the right track or the wrong track is not very good right now.
Interesting. So it's not translating, at least there.
It doesn't seem to be. No. Yeah. But again, a large proportion of voters see the president and, you know, how he's doing through a purely partisan lens.
Right. You know, I want to move on. We got about 4 minutes left in the program, and I want to move on to a question that, in my mind, is a wild card with regard to 2022 or 2024 in particular, and that is the Supreme Court and the Mississippi abortion law that it's going to consider later this session. They kind of made a surprising non-decision that was a decision in the Texas case with that really weird 5-week, abortion law in Texas where citizens, the posse comitatus, enforces it. But I'm thinking if there is a Mississippi abortion decision, and if it does have a big impact on Roe v. Wade, what's that going to do to politics in 2024? Is that going to maybe be a wild card? Is that going to energize things? Is that going to shuffle the deck, so to speak?
I think it will. I think actually that in a political sense, not a policy sense, but in a political sense, that's I think arguably the biggest jolt for the Democrats in a positive direction that they've had in a while. The reason is that the Democratic base, loyal Democrats, are going to be really energized. I mean, I would say abortion is one of the, if not the biggest motivators for the Democratic base in terms of turning out to vote. But also, I think that it is helpful for Democrats for the suburban vote, which they have been gaining in recent years, historically Republican or at least GOP leaning. And in 2018 and 2020, Biden and the candidates in 2018, who were Democrats, made significant gains in states like Texas, in fact. Lots and lots of voters who are kind of, you know, economically conservative or at least moderate, really were sort of repelled by Trump, and started to gravitate towards the Democrats. At the same time, of course, Democrats were losing a lot of longtime Democrats who are in more rural areas who more closely identified with Trump. But I think what the abortion decision does in terms of political motivation is it helps the Democrats shore up suburban voters, particularly women in the suburbs, which for an off-year election, maybe with you know, Trump not directly on the ballot, may not have held up the same degree of margins that that the Democrats got in 2018 and 2020. I think this helps shore up the Democrats in that way.
And they may need an enormous jolt. We're coming down to about a minute in our program. Given that, for example, the races in Georgia and so on, you know, getting those suburban moms to swing Democrat at the right moment could really be a game changer. And I'm thinking back to the difference in turnout between 2012 2016 among, for example, African-American voters.
Yep.
I saw something that suggested that had African-Americans turned out at the same levels in 2016 as they did in 2012, that it would be President Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, definitely, yeah.
Well, we certainly enjoyed our conversation this morning. We definitely will want to have you back because there are a number of important issues that we left on the table. But we've been talking this morning to columnist Lewis Jacobson, who is currently writing a column for the Cook Political Report, Saboteau's Crystal Ball, and U.S. News and World Report. Thank you so much for joining our show today and telling us all about it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Bayou de Bellway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org. krvs.org.
Hi, are you interested in K-pop music but can never find it on your local radio? Well, look no further. With K-pop Fever, we have boy groups, girl groups, soloists, and all of your K-pop favorites. So join me, JC, on Mondays at midnight with KRVS on 88.7 FM radio.
This is Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News correspondent in Paris, bringing France home to Louisiana listeners on NPR's All Things Considered. Parlez-vous français? KRVS brings you news, music, and Louisiana culture en français every day. Écoutez All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6 p.m. right here on listener-supported KRVS Radio Acadie.
Hey guys, this is JC with K-Pop Fever. Be sure to join me Mondays at midnight for all